Support for the morning show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information available at carthage.edu/grad. Support for the morning show also comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. And we welcome you to the Thursday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I have really had the pleasure of late reading a book which I have found so inspiring, called Awakening Hippocrates, a primer on health, poverty, and global service, written by Dr. Edward O'Neill, who is someone who has lived this reality, lived this calling. Dr. Edward O'Neill is a practicing emergency physician at Caritas St. Elizabeth Medical Center in Boston. But he is also someone who has worked extensively overseas, volunteering his services as a medical doctor in places that have desperately needed help. And he has created a group called OmniMed, a non-governmental organization which has tried to facilitate medical physicians volunteering their time and offering their services to places abroad. And they have done extraordinary work. It has made a great difference. And Dr. O'Neill is responsible now for this book and a companion book, which help us better understand why so many people around the world suffer so terribly, both from poverty and from its sort of sister affliction, poor failing health of one kind or another, and the enormous pleasure and benefit to him, all that he has received in giving of himself in this way. And I'm very honored to have Dr. Edward O'Neill Jr. With me for the next few minutes to talk about his book again, called Awakening Hippocrates. Dr. O'Neill, we welcome you to the morning show.
Yeah, thank you for having me, Greg. It's great to be here.
Right off the bat, to satisfy the curiosity of some of our listeners, explain the title of the book.
Well, the title is a metaphor for Hippocrates, of course, is the father of medicine. And the book was really designed to try and awaken the medical profession to the incredible disparities in health that exist in our world. When you look back through any of the literature, any of the people that have researched the involvement of doctors and nurses through time in our country, and in fact, throughout the rich world, what you find is a very small percent of people really have gone abroad and engaged directly in this work. Now, there are certainly icons like Paul Farmer and Tom Dooley and Albert Schweitzer and people like that that have, I think, really raised the bar and set a standard for what we can strive for. But the average health provider in the United States is not involved in this, but so easily could be. And my goal in writing these books was to primarily inspire people and explain the reasons for why we see such health disparities persist year after year, as well as to make it very easy for anybody, whether it's a doctor, nurse, social worker, hospital administrator, and indeed people in outside the medical profession as well, educators and people in government, to get involved and go serve directly. And that really is the goal, to get people involved directly and possibly transform their lives in the process.
And we should maybe clarify that we are talking about two different books, although I hold in my hand the book which is probably likely to be of interest to even people for whom this is probably not their own personal calling. I mean, even people who are not doctors, who have any or have any connection with the medical field, really should read this book. Its companion or sequel, A Practical Guide to Global Health Service, is geared a little more towards someone who is in the health profession who might, in fact, want to do this, and it would help them understand how to do that, although that might also be a very interesting book to read for just about anyone.
Yeah, sure. The book started out as one book, actually. The vision, this began 12 years ago. It's taken a long time to compile the data and get everything clear in terms of the writing. And in the second book, we have over 300 organizations that are looking to get people involved in this work, primarily health providers, but also college students and medical students and people outside the medical profession. It started out as one book called Reverence for Life, which was the term given by Albert Schweitzer to the ethical imperative that we all share to take care of all people. And then because of the length, it ended up being split into two. And you're certainly right. I think Awakening Hippocrates is much more readily accessible to anyone who has ever wondered about those late-night images on television. Why do we still see such incredible poverty a full 60 years after the Marshall Plan? And why is it that 28,000 children under age 5 die every single day of treatable illness? Excellence without equity is the true challenge of our generation, and I would argue it's one of the most important challenges facing humanity at this time.
Let's find out a little bit about you personally and your own life's journey, which eventually took you to some far-flung places in the globe. First of all, you grew up in Boston, I believe, and you are the son of a policeman. And at some point early in the book, you acknowledge the fact that your father and I think your grandfather also, as police officers, were nonetheless valuable examples to you of what it means to make a difference in the world and to serve others.
Sure, but there was always police presence at my house. My father was a policeman for 43 years in Boston, and my grandfather for 37 years in Boston. And I grew up in a law enforcement community, and there are a lot of similarities between what I do and what my father and grandfather did. The police looks to law for guidance, as does Global Health Service, and both are professions of service. And there's no question that my father's example was an inspiration to me. And I think it was that ethical upbringing that, was really both of my parents that provided me the impetus and the moral clarity to act on the things I saw when I first went to Tanzania in 1987. And for the average American that goes abroad and doesn't do necessarily a poverty tour, but has the opportunity to immerse themselves in these settings of incredible poverty, it's a transformative experience, and what I saw in Tanzania was shocking to everything I held as decent and right. And it really impelled me to want to do something about it, and that experience was quite transformative for my life.
Ahead of talking about that, I want to find out about what you were like as a young person growing up. First of all, at what point did you start to feel the tug towards perhaps becoming a doctor? I mean, were you a young person interested in the sciences? And I also wonder, as a young person, in whatever you happen to be involved in, how much awareness did you have of sort of the rest of the world beyond your own backyard of Boston?
That's a good question. I always wanted to be a doctor. I think from when I was probably around 12 or 13, I remember being very interested in it then, and volunteering as an escort messenger at what was then the Peter Bent Brigham Hospital here in Boston. Now it's Brigham and Women's. I was always attracted to it. I always loved the sciences. I was curious about how things worked. And as I went on in school and in education, that melding of science plus a healthy dose of compassion seemed to be the ideal mix for me. And medicine always seemed to be an ideal profession, and it attracted me from the longest time. I don't know when I first became interested in things globally, but I'd always had an interest in the same issues that I see internationally right here at home. I worked in homeless clinics, and I spent my residency at Boston Medical Center, which is the urban hospital for inner-city Boston, and I've always been attracted to that for some reason. And I think some of that is, the influence of my parents and their ethical clarity that they imparted to me, and some of it is faith-based as well. But I think there's a natural attraction between medicine, those who are attracted to medicine for the reasons I was, and these incredible issues in our world that really require much more action than we've seen, and much more direct action from those in the medical profession who can be such important and crucial agents of change, and something we haven't seen anywhere near as much as I think we could see.
You tell a story in the book about being, I think, a third-year medical student at George Washington University, and you heard a lecture being given by someone, which changed everything for you. Tell our listeners about that.
Yeah, I was a third-year medical student, and I don't know his name, but he was a physician that was an internist, and he had just come back from working in Kenya. And while in Kenya, since there was no other doctors available, he became the hospital surgeon, and he told stories of baboons running off with his surgical instruments, and for some reason that was something that really resonated with me. And I became really interested in having a similar experience in going abroad. And that was what sort of tricked a switch in me, and I then pursued an opportunity, and I ended up going to Tanzania less than a year later. And I think there is an inherent predisposition on many who are attracted to this work. I know Father Bill Frida, who is from your neck of the woods in South Dakota. He is someone that early on saw footage of Albert Schweitzer, and then Father Frida ended up spending the last 25 years of his life, most of his adult life, building a hospital and serving the poor in Kenya, Tanzania, and around East Africa. So I think there is a certain resonance that many of us share that are in this, but I also think that many of the people in this profession will find resonance there and really enjoy their experiences when they go abroad.
Hmm. When you made this first journey abroad, you tell us a little bit about just how arduous the journey was. And you don't dwell on that fact a lot, but it's kind of interesting to look at the staggering plane flight and then the staggering overland trip which it took to get you from Nairobi, Kenya, to the place in Tanzania where you ultimately worked. And then, of course, once you got there, what you saw was nothing for which you were prepared at all.
Yeah, that's right. I worked at Makyungu Hospital in Singida, which is in about the middle of Tanzania, and it took a number of hours to fly from Washington, D.C. to London to Nairobi, and then it took 10 days of hitchhiking and getting on buses that broke down and walking and hiking and getting to this mission hospital. And I at that time, was completely unprepared for what I was coming into. And of course, 1987 was a very different time than now, before the Internet, before CNN, before the telecommunications revolution. And I had read some books about Tom Dooley and Albert Schweitzer. I had a sense, but it was really nothing that had at all prepared me for what I was about to see. And that experience, that transformative power, is such an incredible thing. And I think, again, for most people that are attracted to medicine, once you experience this, it's hard to go back. Once you see the people that I saw, for example, these young kids that would come in that would have treatable illness that would end up either dying or losing a limb to gangrene. Or I had one afternoon where three people died of malaria in just a matter of a very short period of time. And those type of experiences really shocked me into saying, my God, why are we seeing these really good people? These weren't people that had faults or were immoral or anything else. These were decent people that were suffering horribly, and it seemed completely unnecessary.
Hmm.
And it struck me at that time how seemingly disengaged my country was and my profession was. And that was the beginning of me, what became really a quest to, number one, to understand why these things happen year after year. And I'd never seen that spelled out in one place. And two, to try and figure out ways that we could get more people involved in productive, effective manner, such that we could start to make inroads in ways that we really hadn't. So it was the beginning of a long quest for me.
Hmm. An awakening, you said. I mean, not just culture shock, but an awakening. We're speaking with Dr. Edward O'Neill Jr. about his book, Awakening Hippocrates. As you tell us about this experience of first arriving in Tanzania and what you saw, you said, I had not previously realized the level of misery that defined existence for so many. I think that's such an interesting way to put it, because on the one hand, we don't like to equate people with their problems. And yet, on the other hand, you know, what you're really saying here is that we are talking about a kind of suffering, a kind of misery, I mean, of such a level that in fact, it really does wash everything else away. I mean, it affects everything in the lives of these people. I think that's what you're saying.
Oh, sure. The health is the predominant human concern and always has been. The Millennial Survey of 1999, where they surveyed more people than any other questionnaire in history, people were asked to rank what's most important in life. And across lines of nationality and faith and gender and race, the single dominant issue was that of health. And when you see the health problems and the health challenges that these people face, you very quickly realize why it is such a dominant issue in their lives in ways that those of us in the rich countries have probably stopped to think about. We don't face the challenges of malaria, where virtually everyone I took care of in Kenya and in Tanzania would just wait for their next bout of malaria, whether it was through pregnancy or a car accident or any other kind of illness. They know it's coming. The threat of HIV/AIDS, which is wiping out the working people and the intelligentsia of many sub-Saharan African countries, is enormous calamity. And these issues are things that I think we have a casual acquaintance with, and the average American on the street would be able to point to those late-night images on television and those campaigns and recognize it. But there's a huge difference between recognizing it as an issue in our world and feeling the extent of the horror that this really represents to those so afflicted.
I want to ask you about something else, which was a real learning experience for you, again, in this initial visit to Tanzania. I mean, not only did you see this misery for yourself, I mean, you said it was so much more powerful than just reading about it, but you also came to a profound appreciation for these people. And you talk about coming to see them as people and not just objects of your benevolence or charity. And in particular, you said, like brilliant flowers blooming from volcanic rock, I saw the beauty of a people trapped in the death grip of poverty and impossible circumstance. They always welcomed you. They were generous to you. And you go on to say these poor people, in quotes, had great insight into life and the ways of man. For many of them, all they had was each other. So they treated each other as life's most precious commodities. They cared for each other in ways that many in the developed world seem to have forgotten. I mean, in many ways, that is as important as anything you say in this book. Because as we talk about some of these issues, this is a point that is not always made.
Yeah, that was one of the more, I think, pertinent and important insights into working with these people, that were really incredible people, that the way that they did care for each other was I think, reminiscent of some in our culture, but unfortunately, so many more in our culture really don't care for each other the way that these people did. People in settings of intense poverty, I have found, are generally much better at living in the moment. They recognize what they have around them, and even though they live in abject poverty, they still find ways to go on and to make life worthwhile and see things of value. I think many people that come from countries like the United States, where we have such a hyper-paced culture that is overly materialistic in so many ways, I think many people find when they work in a developing country, they rediscover the value of sitting down, having a conversation at night. I could walk through my neighborhood on any given night in Newton, which is just outside Boston, and see in windows of every house, you'll see that blue light of television. And I think we have virtual communities where, as in many of these countries, there are true communities. There's a book written called Bowling Alone that really details the decline of society involvement and people in bowling leagues and church groups and rotary clubs and Lions clubs, all these things we used to do much more are all seeing precipitous declines with the rise of the internet and the rise of people getting, you know, watching their television sets. It's a shame, and that's one of the real attractions that we see in these countries, but I think more importantly that we no longer care for each other in ways that I think we could.
Tell our listeners about how this initial experience for you working in Tanzania galvanized you to do more. I mean, from Tanzania, where did you go and what did you do?
Well, from Tanzania, I came back and graduated from medical school and did a residency, which pretty much took up the next 5 years of my life. And I had enormous loans. I borrowed most of my medical school tuition, and it took a couple of years to pay that back. So it was a full 7 years between Tanzania and then getting back to Kenya. But these questions and these insights just bothered me. I had seen what seemed to me to be an incredible disconnect between what was reality in these countries and what is shown to us, which is, I think, largely an illusion in the rich countries, particularly in the United States. And it gnawed at me, and it really bothered me, and I always wanted to go back, and I wanted to spend more time, and I wanted to try and understand. So in 1994, I went back to Kenya, and at that time I worked with Father Bill Frieda in a hospital outside Nairobi. And that time I was able to spend 3 months and have far more insight into these questions. And then I started to look into things like the World Bank and United States AID and United States foreign aid and what some of these larger cultural factors were and historical factors, and to try and decipher, again, why these people were dying so unnecessarily and why we had not done what I had hoped and thought that we had done as a country and as a profession. And I then did a Kellogg Fellowship, which is in leadership development. And that gave me a 3.5-year opportunity to really study these issues of economic growth and development and trade relations and racism and sexism, things that I really hadn't studied much in medical school, but I recognized were so important to understanding why these conditions existed year after year. And then in time, it became clear to me that just simply to understand these issues would only be a partial solution. So that's when I developed OmniMed, which is an organization that takes health providers, mostly physicians, and mostly people that have never been involved in any global service activities before. And we've subsequently sent over 100 people, mostly doctors again, to 4 developing countries right now. And so that's what my life is now, the combination of I work part-time in the emergency department, and now I run OmniMed, and these books have taken a few years. But the net goal being the same as it was in Awakening in Tanzania, which is to try and get some relief and try and help more of the medical profession and others in this country to recognize the incredible disparity that exists and to try and act on it.
Hmm. You help us understand some of what goes on due to factors that often don't make the headlines or that we just don't take the time to really understand. One of them is such an interesting term, which you call structural violence. You say the fact that poor people around the world have shorter and harder lives is the result of human design. Tell us what you mean by this and by this term, structural violence.
Sure, and I think as a prelude to that, I think it's important to recognize that a lot of what we hear in our country, when we talk about poverty, we hear a lot of the mythology that's continually resurfaced and is really dominates certain sectors of our nation and really of our world. The poor are traditionally blamed for their circumstances, for their illness, for the lives that they are forced to lead. And once you start to deconstruct the mythology that surrounds poverty, you start to increasingly realize, as I came to in this book, that the majority of poor in our world are poor not because of their own faults or because of a certain ethnicity or race or religion or location, but they're poor because the forces that are aligned against them are utterly insurmountable. And the term structural violence really incorporates a lot of that. And what structural violence means, essentially, is that the situations, the basic basic structures of society and the way that people are forced to live is what really triggers most of the premature dying. You can look at wars and look at the number of deaths that happen. But when you look at the life expectancy, for example, of someone growing up in Kenya or sub-Saharan Africa, where life expectancy is around 48 years, versus someone that lives to be 78 years in the United States, that 30-year differential represents an enormous number of lives claimed prematurely. And it's claimed not again by just nature, but by forces of human design, trade imbalance, and historical shifts, such as colonization, or such as the great clash, the cultural clash of the Aztec and the Aztecs and the Spanish, for example, on the remnants of slavery, things like that, and sexism, the way that women can't own property, or trade imbalance, the way the World Trade Organization is very much influenced by the richer countries. All these factors and a number of others contribute to the structural violence, the basic way that our world is shaped and designed that prefers those that are affluent over those who are poor. And that's both within countries as well as on the world stage at large.
Hmm. Well, and I think part of what your book helps us understand is not only what the real causes of poverty are, but also it brings to the light of day our indifference. You say people are poor for reasons that are complex and largely invisible to those of us who live in relative comfort in the wealthier countries.
Sure.
And you also say many of the answers to the most pressing questions about poverty lie buried deep under common presuppositions that we rarely challenge. I guess that's one of the things that you hope will happen in this book, is that we will not just glide along easily on our presuppositions about this, but that we will take a longer and more honest look at what is going on in the world and how the United States is perhaps contributing to the situation.
How all of us do. And I don't mean that by that. I don't think that we are mean-spirited or selfish or anything else. I think when you look at what Dickens wrote so long ago in A Christmas Carol, there were two children under the robes of the Ghost of Christmas Present. There was want and there was ignorance. And the spirit had said, mostly beware the boy who is ignorance. And it really is ignorance that is our greatest adversary. When we look at what happens in our world, I think there's a tendency to say, well, they're poor, there's really not much you can do about it. You know, you hear this on the O'Reilly Factor recently, for example, or a number of other talk radio shows in which the poor are demonized. The poor in New Orleans, for example, I was told recently, are poor because of their culture and because of corruption. And these are arguments that go back millennia. This has always been the case. But again, once you start to examine the underlying forces, you're really forced to a completely different conclusion. And you're forced to recognize what is real in the world. And that's uncomfortable for us because Americans, for the longest time, have looked at our role in the world as, I think in some ways rightly, as what we did in World War I, World War II, and the Cold War, as being an important force in the world, the ship of democracy and the foremost advocate of capitalism. Yet the problem is when you look at what else we do in the world, if you look at it from the perspective of the poor, we're not always the world's benefactor, and in many ways we primarily help ourselves. If people look at these issues, if people take the time to deconstruct the forces that cause and perpetuate poverty, people are forced to a different conclusion. And it makes it much harder to write off the poor, to write off those who are traditionally powerless and voiceless. And if anything comes from awakening Hippocrates, I hope that people will come to that conclusion, at least be forced to look a little more critically at these issues and not simply dismiss people. And that's been the traditional response, is to write off people and say, well, why not? We shouldn't waste the money on them, for example. And once we start to understand it, it becomes much harder to do that.
Hmm.
And once you get into foreign aid and start looking at the history of what's gone on in the United States and what we've done, you very quickly recognize that our role in the world from a development standpoint has long been to support our political, strategic, and economic interests and really not to help the poor of the world, despite what a number of surveys have said for decades, that people would like to see the United States helping those in Africa. In fact, three-quarters of the American population, based on one survey in the year 2000, said that they'd be willing to spend an extra $100 a year to eradicate global hunger. And yet, when we look at traditionally and historically what we've done, we have primarily served our own interests from a strategic standpoint mainly. And certainly the Cold War had a lot to do with that. But even since the collapse of the Cold War, the collapse of the Soviet Union, our overall structure and direction of our aid dollars hasn't changed significantly.
Hmm. You do talk about some of the efforts which have gone on. I mean, it isn't that we have been completely, utterly indifferent to these concerns, but you certainly suggest that first of all, America, for instance, does not give the foreign aid that we could or perhaps should, in your opinion. And you also talk about some ways in which sometimes aid can be a bit misguided, and I don't mean even the idea of it being sometimes misdirected, as you've just suggested. I mean, not that we don't necessarily direct our aid to those who need it the most, but think about our own issues like strategy and so on. Beyond that, you give an interesting example of something which you call tailgate medicine, in which sometimes efforts are made to give some help, to make a difference. But I guess you're saying in a way that is kind of haphazard, slapdash, and leads nowhere. Just talk for a moment about that.
Sure. Not all the efforts that go on in our world are necessarily helpful. In fact, many of the larger World Bank programs and programs of the IMF have had good intentions, but have gone horribly awry. And when I talk about tailgate medicine, I talk more specifically about those groups in the United States, primarily, and other countries where, say, a church group or a group of like-minded people will have the very best of intentions, go abroad to a developing country, and ultimately do more harm than good. And this is something from my work overseas I've seen time and again, and as I've gotten to know people in these countries that have been responsible for receiving and helping these groups get oriented and get them placed, it's a constant complaint, and you'll hear that virtually any place that you go. Tailgate medicine in particular refers to a group that may, say, go into a poor country, set up shop in a clinic or a school, treat those who are there, and then leave. And the problems with that are often that maybe there'll be just medical students that are involved, hopes will be raised, and then people don't get better, things don't change, and it can make it more difficult for a more responsible group that comes in after them. And again, part of the motivation for writing Awakening Hippocrates was to really shine a light on this, too. I term this the veil of humanitarianism, in which there are very few people actually studying what goes on behind that veil. And as groups go in, groups can either do great harm or they can do great good. And there's some phenomenal aid groups out there. But it's really difficult to discern who is doing what unless you're there on the ground and you're there in the recipient community. And those voices historically have been muted and not often heard by the outside world. So I think there's a huge importance in getting more people involved in this work. But I think there's equal importance in people taking the time to do what I call the critical reflections before getting involved in this work, to really think about the impact of what they're doing, how the programs were designed, what some of the historical failures have been, and why those failures have taken place.
Hmm. You are also not afraid to raise what is, of course, one of the most troubling and frustrating of situations in Africa and other places in the world, for that matter, something which you call the host factor. You cite a harrowing book by Robert Klitgaard called Tropical Gangsters.
Yeah, sure.
He talks about working in Equatorial Guinea and how the brutal regime there made helping the ordinary people of that country all but impossible. And of course, that is a far from unique story. And that is not an easy problem with which we can deal. What are your thoughts about the difference that this sad reality makes in all of this, and how we should proceed?
Well, there's no question that there are corrupt regimes out there, and there are brutal regimes like those of Marcos in the Philippines, and what Mr. Klitgaard cited, Saddam Hussein, many others throughout the world that have really been parasitic on their people. And regimes like that, unfortunately, have not been selectively weeded out of the aid process. Daniel Arap Moi in Kenya was a recipient of billions and billions of dollars in aid, as was Mobutu Sese Seko in the Congo. And unfortunately, we as a government have long known about these abuses, but as long as it suited our political and strategic aims, we kept the aid dollars flowing. And unfortunately, what that has done is created a quite legitimate target for those who are not interested in supplying foreign aid. Jesse Helms had said for years that U.S. aid dollars were going down foreign rat holes, and it pains those of us who really care about these issues to recognize that he has a point there. The problem that I've found by researching this and looking through it in time is that many of these quote-unquote rat holes were rat holes of our choosing, and we easily could have shifted the dollars away from Mobutu in the DRC, the Congo, to Uganda, for example, or to places where there is more enlightened government. And now there's two factions that look at this. William Easterly from the World Bank is, I think, on one side of this equation, and Jeffrey Sachs from the Earth Institute in Colombia is on the other. And where I come down on this is I recognize that historically aid has been largely a failed enterprise, primarily because the interest in aid was never what the American people and most people in developing countries had thought. The goal of aid historically was never to help the poor. That never was the goal. It was never stated as such by administrations. Kennedy and Nixon both said that aid is a great way to champion American interests in the world. And when you look at that historical fact and then look at the collapse of the Soviet Union and what's gone on afterwards, we have now a unique opportunity to shift aid from what it's been to what it can be. It can be a transformational enterprise. And fortunately, I think there are signs that that is beginning to happen. The Bush administration, to its credit, has piloted the Millennial Challenge account, which is a way that only aid dollars that have shown to be of benefit will be given again. So countries have to apply each year. And if aid is wasted, if aid is not targeted to where it's supposed to go, the country doesn't get any more. And that's a huge paradigm shift from what's happened in the past. Similarly, the Global Fund, which is a UN enterprise that targets malaria, tuberculosis, and HIV/AIDS, is another way, a very creative way, in which aid dollars go to these developing countries for very specific reasons. And if they aren't used as such, the country gets cut off. That's a very different incentive than was traditionally the case when we were using aid dollars primarily to support our own political and strategic interests. And that paradigm shift, I think, is a very important one, particularly since we have an executive branch, a Senate, and a House that is all in conservative Republican hands who traditionally have been the largest opponents to aid. So I think between these issues and the advent of the Global Vaccine Initiative, which the Gates Foundation has twice put $75 million into, I think we're seeing a shift, and it's a very exciting time now with the advent of the Millennial Development Goals that were developed, again, by Jeffrey Sachs' leadership in the United Nations. I think now we have both the blueprint and we have the amount of money necessary to once and for all eradicate extreme poverty and the accompanying illness that has always been there. So the dream is an old one, but the opportunity is of our time alone. And I hope that we as a nation and we as a people and we as a profession can capitalize on it.
We're speaking with Dr. Edward O'Neill Jr. about his book, Awakening Hippocrates. I do want to take just a few minutes here at the end to talk about the inspiring portion of your book, which is devoted to, as you call them, icons and inspirations. Some very important figures who have been in the trenches, I mean, doing this hard and very, very important work. We should mention right off the bat that at the top of the chapter, you acknowledge the fact that you have chosen seven males, and all of all but one are Caucasian. Mm-hmm. And it's probably good that you acknowledge that fact and explain that a little bit, why it is these seven stories that we read.
Yeah, sure. These are stories of people that either I had enough material to read about or people that I've known. And the seven individuals, Albert Schweitzer is probably the most famous of all, and someone that anyone in the medical profession should understand. I think people in our culture should know him anyway. Tom Dooley the same way, an icon in the 50s who's largely been forgotten by the American people. Paul Farmer is someone who is, I think, well-known in the Boston area and increasingly known nationally, and someone that Bill Clinton recently suggested should receive a Nobel Prize, and probably will in some time. But then the others, Jim Yong Kim, who's a friend that is Paul Farmer's colleague, Father Bill Frida, who I worked with and lived with in Kenya, and Peter Allen, who's a dentist in Belize, and Tom Durant, who was a mentor and a longtime activist in the American Refugee Committee. These are people I've had the opportunity to know, and I didn't highlight those in developing countries because despite the many very talented providers I've met through the years, my goal in putting these people in was to primarily inspire people and to show that there are leaders there. There are people we can look to as sources of inspiration. And I think inspiration is crucial to get people that many of whom have thought about this and have long said, geez, I'd love to try that sometime. I think sometimes a little inspiration is all that's needed. Now, there are women out there doing this. There are people of color. Unfortunately, when I looked at the Mellons and when I looked at the others who'd done this work, I just didn't have enough material to work from. So if there are subsequent editions of this book, which I hope, that I'll be able to incorporate other voices in there.
As you look at these seven inspiring figures, one thing that is very striking is that they don't seem like one person times seven. They seem like seven individuals. And that gives us that an Albert Schweitzer and a Father Bill Frida can both be a part of this effort, even though it seems like as people, as personalities, they run the gamut. But it helps us see that it does not have to be one kind of person who can be a part of this and who can make such a difference.
Yeah, I think that's a very important point. And I'm glad that you saw that. And part of the reason for having people as different as Tom Durant, who was just an incredibly inspirational figure and a mentor and a friend for years, who'd been to every hot spot in the world over 30 years, and to Albert Schweitzer, who was driven primarily by religious reasons and who wrote eloquently of the ethical imperative that we all share to care for all the world's people, not just those in our traditional realm of concern, is I'd hope that different people reading this would find resonance with one of these different providers. Peter Allen, who's a dentist that's been in Belize for over 20 years and is now directing the country's planning unit in the Ministry of Health, is a guy that went to Belize and has very strong social justice concerns, but primarily is in Belize because he feels that he can do more and he loves being there. You don't have to get into this work because you feel driven by a missionary zeal or because you feel called by your faith. Many people that do this work just like being in a developing country. And, you know, there's something that a good friend, John O'Brien, is a physician that's been on a number of OmniMed trips, has said, which I think is very true. He said one day in one of these developing countries, for him, is like a month at home in terms of the experiences, the insights that you get into culture, into your own country's policy, into the differences in health. And it's very true. An experience in a developing country is among the most powerful and memorable experiences that many have. And the reasons for going are quite varied from one person to the next.
Hmm.
I think there are many shared feelings, like the ethics and the social justice piece is very common, but there are a lot of different motivations to go.
Right. In particular, of course, you do a great service to the legacy of Albert Schweitzer. He is someone who has been, you know, discussed at great length. And you help us understand really everything about him and his work, including the fact that he comes from another time and another culture. And that helps prepare us for the fact that sometimes when we read the writing of Albert Schweitzer, we might from time to time be taken aback by how he wrote about his work, and in particular about the people of Africa, whom you say he did not exactly see as equals.
No, he did not. And I think it is important to recognize how very different history was at that time. When Albert Schweitzer wrote his books, Life in the Primeval Forest, which was around the 1920s or so, that was a time when many in rich countries viewed people of color as being inferior beings, and some even of a different race. Now, obviously, that strikes very dissonant chords to those of us who live in the modern era, who have long since abandoned any semblance of those views. But he was a man very much of those times, and growing up at a time like that, what Schweitzer wrote about his respect for the natives and how he worked with them and lived among them and talked about their culture was very different to the ears of someone living at that time who were more accustomed to reading about Stanley's exploits through the jungle and the primitive peoples that they described as subhuman. Schweitzer did say things that W.E.B. Du Bois took issue with. Schweitzer would commonly say, you are my brother, but I am your elder brother. And Schweitzer, who was probably the most accomplished man of his generation and arguably one of the most accomplished human beings of all time, did have those views. And again, those sound dissonant to us, but I think it's important to recognize just how progressive he was in his time. But I think the legacy of Schweitzer is one that is still so critically important to us as doctors, but as people in quite involved in shaping the events of our world. Schweitzer talked about reverence for life, which impels all of us to care for all the life around us. And his voice, while people know him, they don't know his story, they don't know his sacrifice, and they don't understand fully just how valuable that view of caring for all people is to us. And the nice thing about reverence for life that I like is Schweitzer didn't ask us to think about these issues. He said, we have a compulsion to act. We can't just look at these issues and study them and think about them. We are obliged to go into the world and to make a difference. And he had said famously years ago, my life is my argument. And his life was spending most of 50 years working in some very difficult conditions in what his daughter Rena had described as a monk-like existence in some very harsh terrain in West Africa. In fact, he went bankrupt at age 71. His hospital was on the verge of closing, and it was only a loan that came from a bank, actually right here in Newton, Massachusetts, that bailed him out at that time. And when you look at the life of what Schweitzer and Dooley and Paul Farmer and many others endure, there are enormous sacrifices and challenges that they take, but I think they're inspirational and examples that we can all look to.
Dr. Edward O'Neill, his book is called Awaking Hippocrates, a primer on health, poverty, and global service. And the organization which he created to help facilitate service around the world is called OmniMed. I'm Gregory Berg. There'll be no morning show tomorrow or Monday because of the Easter holiday, but the morning show is then next week, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, will be devoted to candidate forums for candidates for the Racine Unified School District's school board. Support for the morning show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses designed for the working adult. Information at carthage.edu/grad. Support also comes from Andrea's, Kenosha's Easter store since 1911, featuring Fannie Mae buttercream eggs, Madeleine milk dark and white chocolate bunnies, old-fashioned fruit-flavored Pecton jelly beans, and Buddy Squirrel and Russell Stover eggs. Andrea's, 24th Avenue and 60th Street in Kenosha. A weather forecast for cloudy, windy conditions and a mixture of rain and light snow and sleet. Possibly an inch of accumulation, a high today of 39 degrees. Cloudy and windy with a little light snow tonight. No accumulation expected, low of 22. By tomorrow, Friday, sunshine and a high of 43 degrees. It looks like clouds on Saturday and Sunday, especially on Sunday, a pretty good chance of rain. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn.